This is tape number four, side one of the ongoing interview with Professor of Mathematics Richard Brualdi, February 5th, 2007. Richard, in this three-year period leading up to your receiving tenure on the start of your career here, what were the essential components of your research program at this time, even as you were starting your teaching career?
My research basically was along the lines of my PhD thesis at Syracuse University. It concerned, by and large, what I call combinatorial properties of matrices. In particular, there is this important combinatorial counting function, which is called the permanent, and my research dealt with inequalities connected with this function, some relationships between that and sort of classical linear algebra invariants. And I mentioned one of the this collaboration that I had with my two colleagues, Hans Schneider and Seymour Parter, was dealt with this, but was a bit more analytic than I was used to. Dealt with what was called the diagonal equivalence of a non-negative matrix to a doubly stochastic matrix. Let me explain what that is. So a non-negative square matrix simply means that the entries are non-negative numbers, and you want to rescale the matrix by multiplying all the elements in the rows by a certain positive number and all the elements in the columns by another certain positive number, and ending up with a matrix where all the sums, the sum of the elements in each of the rows and the sum of the elements in each of the columns, is equal to one. It's called a doubly stochastic matrix. And this has important implications for probability. It had important implications for some statistical analysis, which I won't go into there, into that. I also wrote, I didn't mention this before, a paper with a colleague who a very distinguished colleague who was visiting here for a couple of years. His name was Helmut Wieland. He was a wonderful mathematician who worked both in matrix theory, which was one of my areas, and in group theory, which was not. And I had a conjecture concerning these stochastic matrices, which I mentioned to him, and together we solved this. We showed the conjecture was true, and I was extremely pleased to have a joint paper with such a big shot in mathematics at the time. So that's by and large what it was, except there was one other topic that I became interested in at the time, and this was, which is related but in a slightly different way to my other research, to what were called transversals, or systems of distinct representatives of families of sets, this and matroids. And this sort of was a topic that, even though it went back to the 1930s, all of a sudden became fashionable among combinatorialists. There was a lot of research going on in the 60s in this area. It was a popular area. I sort of got into this area and did some research in this type of in this topic for a few years. I don't remember exactly, half a dozen years or more. Eventually, if I talk about my research later, I came back to this, and it's been a theme of my research for many, many years, and continues to be a theme there. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that sort of surprised me when I first came here to Madison was that the algebra group, this is sort of the area, my area of mathematics fell within the algebra group, and there may have been 10 or 12 people in this group, maybe a little bit more, I can't remember. But the algebra group, as a group now, had a National Science Foundation research grant. Those were the days when, early days of NSF, I guess I was, would say, where there was less restriction, less competition for grants. And much to my surprise, After I had been hired in the spring of 65, and I guess the algebra group had put in a new research proposal, they included my name on the proposal. So much to my surprise, that first summer, I had National Science Foundation support. Okay. Huh. That, of course, would never happen nowadays. It's so much more difficult. The competition is stiffer, and the expectations in a proposal are a lot stiffer. I mean, I wrote absolutely nothing, whatever they said. That I probably it was said that I was coming to the University of Wisconsin, and that I worked in the following area, and that I was a good addition to the department, and that was probably it. Okay, and so they had this big NSF grant, which continued for a number of years. I think it may have been renewed once more when I was still on it. But I think later the National Science Foundation decided that we really shouldn't be submitting such a proposal for such a large group, that the groups ought to split up into smaller groups. And so, in fact, my colleague Hans Schneider and I split up into a group. I think it was just the two of us, although I have a vague recollection of somebody else, but whom I don't know. But it was by and large, in any case, Hans and me, and we submitted a proposal, and it was funded, and we had NSF funding for quite a number of years. I'm trying to remember exactly the year that it stopped, but it certainly went from 1966 to 1996 or 7, something of that that sort. So for 30 years, we had support from the National Science Foundation for our support or for our research, and that, of course, was extremely helpful. It provided summer support, it provided travel support, it provided support for graduate students. In those days, there was also support for supplies within the department. I don't know to what extent that continues anymore these days, but they're a little bit more stingy with the kind of money that NSF gives, because there's a lot more demands on the money that they have available.
And what work was this supporting?
It was supporting whatever research we were doing, combinatorics, matrix theory.
Sort of open-ended?
Well, no. When you write a proposal, you sort of highlight what you've done in the recent past and what you hope to do in the near future. Okay, and so that would include indicating specific problems that you wanted to work on. Often it would be the case that you would say you had some partial results in this area, and you want to continue the research in these particular topic. And that's the way it is today. You review what you've done, you look forward to what you hope to do, and these things are reviewed by people at NSF, and they send them out for peer review within the community of the United States, etc. And
were these 3-year grants or 5-year?
They were in general 3-year grants. There was a time when NSF said they'd consider 5-year grants, and I think maybe Hans and I did have a 5-year grant at one time, although I don't remember exactly. So if you wanted to get continuing money from NSF, you had to continue to do research, okay, and published good papers in quality journals, and that was looked kindly on by your colleagues also working in this area, because they were the ones that were going to be reviewing your, some of them were going to be reviewing your proposal there. I did mention that I got interested in this topic of systems of distinct representatives, transversal theory, and matroid theory. And there were two people at the University of Sheffield, England, who were prominent in this area. They were Leon Mirsky and Hazel Perfect, and it was because of that I applied for a NATO postdoctoral fellowship to go to the University of Sheffield for a year. Okay, mm-hmm. And I did get that fellowship, and I did go to Sheffield for the year 69-70, summer of 69 to summer of 70. But maybe I should go back a little bit, because The years in the late 60s, of course, were the years where there was a lot of upheaval in the United States concerning the Vietnam War, and that certain upheaval certainly as was at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. When I was living in university houses at the time in the 60s, my first years here in Madison, there were also a lot of young radical English professors living in university houses, one of whom is still my friend today and is still here in Madison. The others, I think, never got tenure at the University of Wisconsin. So I was involved to some extent in what was going on in campus and what was going on among the faculty here at the university. I remember going in evenings to certain marches. I remember as a group of faculty marching within a demonstration. I remember in one instance of going down to City Hall where the City Council was meeting. I think Bill Dyke was mayor at the time, and they were considering some proposals concerning what was going on the streets in Madison, etc. And so we marched down to the City County building, and I remember Bill Dyke coming out, meeting us, and saying that he would allow one of us to come into the meeting. Okay, I guess it was crowded, to speak to the group. So I remember that time was sort of my first taste of tear gas as well, okay, which was, of course, rather common at the time with the demonstrations here in Madison. And I remember the big demonstration just outside of Van Vleck Hall here between Bascom Hall and what was then Commerce Building, now called Ingraham Building. That was the first instance where the police went into a sit-down demonstration there and forcibly removed the people from that demonstration. I wasn't in the building, but I certainly saw what was going on in the building. I remember demonstrations within Van Vleck Hall, okay, where students would go into classrooms, into large lectures, and disrupt them so that people could not teach their classes. The halls of Van Vleck, at least in the basement levels where the classes were held, were often filled with shouting demonstrators.
Were your classes interrupted?
I don't think I was teaching a large lecture at that time. And there was, for the most part, I think the demonstrations took place within the large lectures. And this was also the time of the Black Student Movement. Again, I'm afraid I don't remember the exact dates, but I believe that was in the 60s, late 60s as well. And frankly, the demonstrations for the Black Student Movement and the demonstrations for the Vietnam War, they were related, and they're sort of mixed up, all jumbled in my mind. I don't remember, can't distinguish between one and the other. But it was a very difficult time within the university here. And I say I participated in it somewhat. Now, one of the targets of the demonstrators who were demonstrating against the Vietnam War was the Mathematics Research Center, also known as the Army Math Research Center, because it was the finances for that came from the United States Army. And that was housed over in Sterling Hall, which is adjoined to Van Vleck Hall at the time. And there were a few of us in the department who were concerned about the support that the Army was giving to the research center. I don't think we really believed that the people were doing secret research, okay, that was going to be a benefit to the department. View was that the research they were doing was open. Of course, they people who were funded by the Army Math Research Center did occasionally, from what I understand, go consult with people in the United States Army. Okay, they may wanted to know some information for design of whatever, okay, or for whatever they were doing. And so there were certainly instances where people at the research center did consult with people in the United States Army. But the Army Math Research Center was a symbol on campus, okay? It was a symbol to attack, okay? If you were attacking the Vietnam War, it was a symbol that students and faculty, et cetera, could attack. So there was some opposition to the research center. I was part of that opposition. And in fact, there were a number of us who did something that I don't know whether I regret or not, but certainly it was very upsetting to some people in the department. The research center was, as they usually did, they sponsored conferences occasionally. And there was a conference coming up that they were going to sponsor. And a few of us, and I was not the ringleader in this, but a few of us actually wrote a letter to some of the people who were invited to come to this conference and telling them not to come, okay, because of opposition to the war, etc., and opposition to the center being on campus during those times. And so that upset some people in the department. This must have happened in the year 68-69, after I got tenure, I think. Not that I think it would have influenced whether or not I had gotten tenure, but I believe it was after I had gotten tenure. And frankly, I guess I don't know. If I hadn't had tenure at the time, would I have gotten involved in mm-hmm. something of that sort? So having tenure certainly promotes free speech and activities that possibly you'd think twice about getting involved with if you didn't have tenure here at the university. So that was, to some extent, exciting time, okay, in Madison.
Did you all in the department know which of your colleagues were supported by the Army Research?
Oh yeah, that was well known. Yeah,
common knowledge.
It was common knowledge. Yeah, there was no question of who. There were people who were sort of considered permanent members there who were just at the Mathematics Research Center. Some of them had tenure within the department, but they were either not teaching or just teaching one course a year, and that was the expectation that they would be supported by the Army, and their affiliation with the department was small, okay, mm-hmm. one semester or one course a year. So this was a difficult time, and it was also, as I say, an exciting time. And so that was 68-69. I participated somewhat, but I never spoke to student groups or anything of that sort. Okay, mm-hmm. By and large, I was a quiet participant, except for this one instance where we did write this letter, we did upset a number of people in the department.
Was the letter effective?
I don't think so. I think everybody who had planned to come to the meeting did come, uh-huh. did come to the meeting. And this, of course, continued into the year 69, but that was the year that I went to the University of Sheffield, England, on this NATO postdoctoral fellowship. My family, my wife, and my two young children at the time, and this was an exciting thing for us. It was the first time out of the United States for me, and we did it big, so to speak. We crossed the Atlantic on the SS France, leaving out of New York City and crossing the Atlantic. Nowadays, it's very rare for people to cross on the steamship, but this was a 4.5-day trip across the ocean to England, arriving in Southampton, picking up a car there. We had actually made arrangements to buy a car there, but it wasn't ready, and so we had a different car at the time. But of course, the steering wheel was on the right side. It was driving on the left side of the road, all the way driving in Southampton and driving up to Sheffield, England. So that was it was a very good year. The two new colleagues there, Hazel Perfick and Leon Mirsky, and then there was another fellow there, John Pym, who was partially interested in some of these things. So I had a very good year there. All I had to do was to do my mathematics. I had no duties, no obligations. Nobody was checking up on me. I came in the morning. I worked on what I wanted to work on. I collaborated with Hazel Perfect and John Pym. I never did actually write anything with Leon Mirsky. It turns out Leon Mirsky was actually at the time writing a book on this topic, Transversal Theory Systems of Distinct Representatives. So we would often talk, and some of my work figured prominently in his book, and he also thanked me for, you know, any other contributions that I may have made to the book. So it was a new culture. I enjoyed it very much. My kids went to school.
In the public schools?
Well, my son went to the public school. My daughter wasn't quite old enough, and she went to a Montessori school.
Huh?
And my son experienced what was called at the time, and maybe is still called, open classroom, where the students don't sit at desks facing the teacher, but there are various areas within the classroom that students go, and they work on these areas with other students, okay, and the teacher comes around and helps them and talks to them, etc. And he thrived in that sort of situation. I guess it was first grade that he was in at that time. And we traveled a bit around England, went to a conference at the Oxford University, visited there at a later time, went to a conference in Brest, France. We took a trip to the continent, going as far as, the first time I guess we went only to as far as Salzburg, I think it is. We went down through France, into Italy, over into Austria, to Germany, and then up into Holland, as I believe, and then got back to to England. The second trip I took, so that was sort of a trip just for pleasure. The second trip we took went all the way to Budapest, Hungary, by train, where I had given a talk, and I had another colleague, Mike Bleacher, at the time, who happened to be spending a year in England, in London, I think it was. And sort of we met up on this trip, and we both went to Budapest together. And so that was an interesting experience to be in a communist country.
Oh, that's right. It was still
under Soviet domination at the time. We traveled, as I say, all the way by train. We traveled back by train through East Germany, because we crossed from Munich to Berlin by train, and we had to go through East Germany at the time. And I remember every couple of hours the passport control people would come on the train and would want to check your passports, etc. And but there was nothing other than special about that, except being wakened during, I think it was an overnight trip, every couple of hours by passport control. And we went to Berlin, saw Berlin, and we did travel, while we were in Berlin, into East Berlin. We went through what was called Checkpoint Charlie at the time, and spent an afternoon in walking around East Berlin, and then back to West Berlin, and then continuing our journey back to Sheffield, England. I also, during that time, spent the summer of 70, in Copenhagen, the University of Copenhagen, Denver, not for any particular reason, other than my colleague Mike Bleacher was also going to spend some time there, and we just thought, well, let's go somewhere different. I had freedom to do my research wherever I wanted to do it, and so we spent a month in Copenhagen before coming back to the United States. So
Did you go at all to the ancestral homeland of Italy?
Well, we did go to Italy, but we didn't go to the ancestral homeland. We visited Rome and Pisa and Florence and Venice during these two trips, but we didn't go to the ancestral homeland, to Pesaro, where my family all came from. But it was a very productive year. I did a lot of work. I wrote a lot of papers. I had time to think. I didn't have teaching obligations. I didn't have committee obligations. And so under those circumstances, you can accomplish quite a bit if you want to. Okay, and I did. Okay, and
were you making the kind of connections here with other scholars that stood you in good stead as your reputation grew nationally and internationally?
Do you mean scholars in England at the time?
Yes.
Yes, certainly. I had these connections with Leon Mirsky, Hazel Perfick. Another person who was prominent in this area at the time was a fellow named Dominic Welsh in Oxford University. In fact, he wrote a book on what was matroid theory. I mentioned that word before, the topic before, and so I connection with him. I made some connections with people in Budapest, and that'll come back later as you'll see. We spent 4 days in Budapest, and I got to know some of the people there. So after Copenhagen, we flew back to the United States. We didn't take a boat back through Iceland, which was typical at the time. Okay, Icelandic air was cheap. People often flew and stopped, and we stopped at Reykjavik, Iceland for a few days there, and landed in JFK Airport, and were greeted by my wife's parents with a copy of that day's Daily News with the bombed-out Stirling Hall on the front page. This was a shock.
The day you got
the
back.
The day we came back, I guess it happened the day before, it had made the front page of the New York Daily News, and there they showed us this paper with, there it was, the bombing had taken place, person had been killed. They showed what the Stirling Hall looked like at the time as a result of the bombing, and that was a tremendous shock, okay, to see that. So we spent a couple of days in New York. I can't remember how many days, and then drove back to Madison. We had our car was shipped back that we had bought in England, and drove back to some chaos to some extent. I guess you would say this. I don't remember the exact day we came back, but within 2 weeks of the bombing, that's all I can say for sure. My office was a bit of a mess. Because my office was facing Stirling Hall, and so the windows were broken. There was glass in my office. A chair had ripped as a result of some glass, I guess, flying into it. And so these were difficult times within the department.
Richard, were you completely surprised that the bombing had taken place, or was in your mind a certain inevitability about it?
No, I was completely surprised about that. There were violent demonstrations on campus, but if there was property damage, it was, I would say, minimal. You know, people wrote slogans on buildings, etc. That kind of damage certainly existed, but I certainly was very surprised to see that some people were so against the mathematics research center. As I say, it was really a symbol. Okay, mm-hmm. They were really protesting the Vietnam War by attacking this symbol, which existed on campus. And so it was a huge surprise, a huge upset for me.
And what was the reaction within the department to that?
Well, I mean, I think it was similar to my reaction. If you're asking whether somehow those of us on the faculty who had been a bit vocal concerning the Vietnam War, who may have sent this letter about the Mathematics Research Center, whether they were blaming us to any degree, I would say no. Okay, nobody, there were no repercussions of any sort against me. I should say, because I mentioned property damage, while I was away in Sheffield that year, there was a conference sponsored by the Mathematics Research Center. It's a conference that I would have participated in had I been here, because it was in areas that I was interested in my area of mathematics. And there was this one incident, maybe you're aware of it, where students during one of the lectures, this was took place in what is now called the Pyle Center on Langdon Street on campus, students came into one of the lectures, disrupted it. They had red paint, and they splattered red paint over the room, over the participants, to disrupt this conference.
Really?
Yeah,
no,
I know people that I knew had gotten paint splattered on them in this particular incident. As I say, interesting, since I was opposing the Mathematics Research Center, I said I probably would have participated in it, but maybe I wouldn't have. I don't know, because of the situation at the time. I may have decided to boycott it. I'm not sure, frankly.
This concludes side one of tape four. This is side two of tape four, Richard Brualdi. Richard, you returned to Madison at a traumatic time, 1970. And where does your career on campus and in mathematics go in the decade of the 1970s?
So returning from my year abroad, I resumed my teaching career and university career, research career. In the early 70s, I did decide to develop a new undergraduate course. It's Math 475, which was Introduction to Combinatorics. Mm-hmm. The first time I taught it, I used what was basically one of two available books at the time. I didn't like the book, and so I decided that I would try to write my own book. So I taught that course several times, maybe once a year, or maybe even twice a year, I can't remember, for a few years, developing my notes, and eventually finished the writing of this book, Introductory Combinatorics. I sent it out for review to, I think, three publishers. Only one was interested, and they were willing to publish it, so I signed a contract with this publisher. This was Elsevier Science Publishers, and it was published in 1977. So this was an important activity during my time, besides doing my research. I've mentioned my colleague Hans Schneider, and in 1968, there was a new journal called Linear Algebra and Its Applications, which was developed, and this was actually one of the first sort of specialized journals in mathematics. For the most part, journals in mathematics had been general journals. Any topic, you can submit a paper to journals, to a journal, but this was one of the first journals where it was on a particular area of mathematics, okay? And my colleague Hans Schneider was an original member of the editorial board of this journal, and in 1972 he took over as editor-in-chief of this journal because the founding editor-in-chief wasn't doing a satisfactory job. He was a bit too organized to be an editor-in-chief of a journal. And within a few years after becoming editor-in-chief of this journal, Hans asked me to become a member of the editorial board, which I accepted. And I have to say that this has really had a profound effect on my career. Okay? So, you know, being at least certainly at that time a member of an editorial board of a journal in the area or one of the areas that you work on, okay, is a big deal, okay? Your name is prominent, okay? People read the journal, they see you're a member of an editorial board, it must be your big shot, you're good, okay? Or something of that sort, okay? So it was a big deal, and I, you know, worked in this journal by handling papers, either refereeing them myself or getting other referees to the journal. And in 1979, I'll come back to some other things in the 70s, but in 1979, or maybe before 79, but Hans asked me to join him as co-editor-in-chief of this journal. Oh. So, 79, I became with Hans co-editor-in-chief of this journal, Linear Algebra and Its Applications, and to this day, we still are co-editor-in-chiefs of this journal, and we also have a third one, Volker Mehrmann, who works out of Berlin. He's at the Technical University of Berlin. So I've been co-editor in chief of this journal with Hans for, well, I guess I'm in my 28th year right now. And this, of course,
impressive,
has had an even more profound effect on my career. Now, I mean, if being a member of the editorial board means something, then being an editor in chief of the journal means a lot more. And so I think this has certainly helped me considerably in terms of advancement and prominence within the field of linear algebra.
I assume that that keeps you in touch with the developing new talent in this field.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in the 70s, the journal was relatively small journal. I can't remember how many pages were published every year, but it was certainly initially 500 to 1,000 pages a year, probably, something of that sort. Now we publish about 6,000 pages a year. And last year, the number of submissions of papers for possible publication in our journal exceeded 800. Okay. And our publication or acceptance rate is somewhere between 40 and 50%, I would say, something of that sort. So this field has developed considerably. In fact, I think having that journal played a role in the development of the field in that it becomes more visible. Okay, people see the journal, see the area, maybe read some stuff, maybe say, oh, I can do some of that stuff, or that's interesting. And so there are a lot of people that are now working in this area, and the area has just expanded considerably. So this was a big thing in my development here. I went to Sheffield, as you know, from 69 to 70. I also, 4 years later, took another trip abroad. My wife and I at the time thought it might be nice to go back to Budapest, to go to Eastern Europe. And we found there was the possibility of a program that we could apply to, or that I could apply to try to get funding. And this was the National Academy of Sciences Exchange Scholar Program. Okay? And so I applied to this program to go to Budapest. There was a Institute of Mathematics in Budapest, and there were a number of people prominent in the field of which I was interested in there. I remember at the time, because going to Eastern Europe was not a trivial thing. You just don't pack up your bags and go to Eastern Europe. And one of my colleagues that I mentioned previously, R.H. Bing, was a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And he had to interview my wife and I to see whether he thought we were up to living in a communist country, and in a country where we didn't know the language, where living would not be so easy. And so he interviewed us. I guess he gave us an okay that we could do it. And I was awarded this six-month fellowship, and we went to Budapest, England in January of 74 and stayed there through June of 74. That was a very interesting experience for us. When we arrived, they didn't really have an apartment for us. They were supposed to make arrangements for us there. And so we actually lived, the four of us, my wife and two young children. So my son was about 11 at the time, and my daughter was about 8 or 9. And so we lived in two rooms in a private home, sharing their bathroom, sharing their kitchen. That was a bit hard. This was for 2 months. I mean,
was this another academic?
No, I didn't know it. In fact, I don't recall what these people did at all. Okay. They didn't speak English too much, although the daughter spoke a bit of English, and so when we had to talk to them, we basically talked with the daughter there. So that was very difficult time, not knowing the language. It's a big city, of course. You have to get used to the surroundings. You have to get used to, I mean, just sort of shopping in a grocery store to pick up food and then having a shelf on a refrigerator to put your food and to cook. So we didn't eat too well, obviously, during that time, and I suppose we ate out a bit in some of the restaurants. I didn't mention, but let me just digress a bit. When I was in England in 69-70, I mentioned Hazel Perfect. Hazel Perfect had been a vegetarian for most of her life. I had always associated vegetarianism with very thin people. She wasn't fat, but she wasn't thin, just normal. My wife and I all had vegetarian tendencies. We decided to become vegetarians when we were in Sheffield, England. We sort of changed overnight, okay? Here you are, a meat eater, tomorrow you're not eating meat. And that was difficult to get used to. That was not so easy at that time to be a vegetarian. I brought that up because here we are in Budapest, England. We were vegetarians, okay, and they're big meat eaters in the Hungarian people. But we managed, and my daughter went to the school of the British Embassy.
Oh.
And my son went to a school of the American Embassy. They had just started the school, which was going from 5th grade to 8th grade or something like that, and the British school was kindergarten to 5th grade or something in that vicinity there. So my son's school may have had 8 or 9 students total. I can't remember, but so they did okay there. We used to go by metro. We got on the metro, and eventually my daughter and I and son, and at some stop, he would go off on a different metro and go to the American school, and I would go with her on the other metro and leave her off at the British Embassy and walk to the Mathematic Institute from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, so that was, you know, it was an interesting time living in a different culture, and it wasn't easy. We took some lessons in Hungarian in order to try to get by in the marketplace and restaurants. Once a week for 8 weeks, we had a tutor that taught us something about Hungarian, which is a very different language than English. And eventually we got an apartment of our own. It was glorious. It was very small, but it was glorious to have basically 3 rooms and a little kitchen with not having to worry about anybody else floating, and your own bathroom. Okay. The institute was very good for me. The accommodations there weren't all that great. I shared an office with 2-3 other people, and one of them was a big chain smoker and who smoked all the time. He was a very nice fellow. I liked him a lot, but he smoked, so I was working in a smoke-filled room. And it turns out there was, at the same time I was there, another person who was coming from McMaster University, spending time in Budapest, who in fact had been a Hungarian and had left during the 1956 uprising,
mm-hmm.
that had gone to Canada. And so he was on some special deal, I don't know, some special program being funded, and he was there at the same time, and he also had to sign the same office, so there were 4 of us in this small office there. And I had more common interests with him than I had with the Hungarian people in
mm-hmm.
Budapest, the other Hungarian people. So we worked together. So that's primarily what I did in Budapest, was to work with him on certain mathematical topics of
common interest. Was English the working language for mathematicians?
Yeah, it was the working language. The people that I was in my office, I mean, they spoke English. They had, you know, traveled outside. They wrote papers in English.
Mm.
I remember giving, maybe this was on my first trip to Budapest, where I gave a talk there. I gave it in English, but it was translated spontaneously by somebody there into Hungarian.
Uh-huh.
So I gave it in English, I wrote on the board, but there was somebody translating it into Hungarian. But the people at the Institute spoke English. They had to speak English somewhat, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to participate in international mathematical activities, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very good year, or very good 6 months in Budapest. I came back to Madison, resumed my career. During the 70s, I also developed some other courses. These were on the graduate or almost graduate level, in one case, course in what is called error-correcting codes, coding theory, which is used for reliability of data transmission. Even though I'm not an engineer, I don't know exactly how these things are implemented by engineers. But it was a combinatorial topic, used linear algebra, both of the things I had been interested in. And so I developed two graduate courses there. This course was Math 641, which is in that gray area between undergraduate and graduate. And I talked to the people in electrical computer engineering because of the connection there, and they wanted to joint list the course. Oh. And then there was a second course, 842, which was topics in error correcting codes, which was also joint listed. And I also developed a graduate course called Introductory Combinatorics, which I've taught at many times during my career here. And I think I think good job that I must have done in teaching, and the development of these courses and some of the other things that I may have been doing for undergraduates, getting involved with the undergraduate math club. There was a program called the Mathematical Talent Search Program, which was a program for high school students, sending out 4, 5 or 6 times a year problems, mathematical problems that didn't require a lot of background to solve, but required some ingenuity. This was a program that had been developed earlier by my colleague Elsie Young, first time I've ever mentioned Elsie Young, which was modeled actually after a Hungarian program. And this program still exists to this day, but I worked on this in the 60s and 70s, frankly, I don't remember the exact dates, and in fact was instrumental in getting a similar program started in Alabama.
This program just works searching for smart kids in the state,
in
right?
the States, but the problems now, the problem sheets are actually on the web, so anybody can access them, and they do get sometimes solutions from people outside of the state of Wisconsin as well. And in fact, we actually get now solutions from middle school students. We have some very bright middle school students in the state who do extremely well on some of these problems and do well enough to get invited to the Honors Day that there is for this program every April, May, where they invite the best participants to come and give them some prizes, give them some recognition, et cetera. So,
are these kids then on the fast track for admission here?
Well, there's no special brownie points or whatever you want to call them that they get. I mean, they could put this down in their application that they participated, but it doesn't give them any other special privileges than
that. See.
And unfortunately, of course, some of the very best students go to Harvard, go to Princeton, go to MIT, rather than come to the University of Wisconsin. That's often the case. But we get quite a number of them coming to Madison. So I think there are a number of things that I can, I guess, I mean, because I don't know for sure, that contributed to my getting the Chancellor's Distinguished Teaching Award in 76, I believe, that I was received that award. I paid a lot of attention to my teaching. I paid a lot of attention to my students. I developed courses. I wrote this undergraduate textbook. Presumably the word of mouth was that the students thought I was a good teacher. In fact, you know, even today I still get, there's some fellow in Madison who I've met at the Overture Center who was in my introductory combinatorics course, I don't know when, in the 70s I guess it was, who when I saw him, and I didn't recognize him, but he recognized me, he still remembers that course. It was the best course he ever had. And then another time, subsequent to that, I met him and he was with his son. And his son, I'm still teaching the course, and his son wants to take the course. His son is a high school student who comes to the university and takes some mathematics courses. And he asked me when I was going to teach that course again, because he wanted to take the course from me like his father did.
You like teaching.
I like teaching, right, very, very much. I like Most aspects of teaching. One of the aspect of teaching I don't like is grading papers, grading examinations, for instance. That's no fun, frankly. You do it, you have to do it, okay? It's an important part of teaching, but I don't know anybody who say they like grading examinations. I like teaching small classes, and I actually like teaching large lectures, too. There's something, I guess I would call exhilarating, about being on a stage with 150, 200 students there listening to you or interact. Well, you don't, there isn't too much interaction with lectures, but there's something, as I say, whether it's the particular showmanship that I have or whatever, but I really have enjoyed being on a lecturing in large lecture classes.
What do you do with smart students who don't have aptitude for math but are interested? How do you teach them?
Well, it's a difficult question, of course. The students that don't have aptitude certainly don't go very far in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
But I taught, for instance, 4 years ago, I think it was, a course, our course Math 114. It's a 5-credit course, 3 lectures, 2 discussions a week. It's college algebra and trigonometry. It's basically our college algebra course, Math 112, and our trigonometry course, Math 113, rolled up into one. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And students, to get into that course, because it's a 5-credit course, have to have, first of all, they need both algebra and trigonometry, and they have to do a little bit better on the placement exam than those students who are, say, taking 112 or just taking 113. I think, you know, so what do you do with students who, like these students who maybe don't have an aptitude, who maybe have had similar material in high school, because most students take a college algebra or algebra courses in high school and usually some trigonometry, and didn't succeed on it. Well, I think there are several things. One, first of all, is you've got to teach at the level of the students. Okay. Now, of course, in these courses, the level varies a bit, okay? You can't gear it at the lowest level and you can't gear it at the highest level, but you've got to find some compromise level, okay, that you hope that students of all aptitudes will be able to understand, to be able to learn from. So I think that's extremely important, is to know where your students are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I think an important part of teaching is enthusiasm for the subject. And you've got to show that enthusiasm, especially true in large lectures. If you're bored, okay, with talking about this material, or think it's beneath you, or think you shouldn't be teaching this kind of stuff at the college level, the students are going to find that out, okay, and they're going to turn off, okay. So I have no trouble in being enthusiastic about teaching college algebra and trigonometry. Early on in my career, I taught a course which was called Math 101, which was intermediate algebra, which is a course, it's really high school algebra course.
Mm.
And I enjoyed teaching that a great deal. These were students who really were very poor in mathematics, for whatever reason. They didn't learn the material, they weren't taught it well, or whatever. And I had no trouble getting down to the level of that course, to being enthusiastic about teaching stuff like the quadratic equation, okay,
mm-hmm.
the quadratic formula, how to solve simple equations, how to do simple graphing, simple inequalities. And at the time when I was teaching that course, the lecturer that was associated with this course sort of a laboratory, where the laboratory was staffed by either the teaching assistants or the faculty teaching, lecturing in the course, and students could go into this at the times it was open and get help. In that sense, it was a laboratory, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There was no lecturing, but it was sort of one-on-one with students trying to find out what their problems were, etc. And so, as a lecturer, I was expected to do that 2 hours a week. And I did that, and I taught that course for 4 consecutive semesters, this Math 101 Intermediate Algebra. And in my fourth time teaching that course, I noticed in the laboratory associated with that, I was starting to get a little impatient with the students. Okay, you know, you could sort of say, didn't I just teach you this? Okay, you know, after four consecutive semesters at teaching that mm-hmm. stuff, I noticed I was getting a little impatient, and I decided it was time to take a break from that course, and I did take mm-hmm. a break from that course. But so I think, you know, getting down to the level of the students is extremely important. Showing enthusiasm is extremely important. I think one has to be organized. I think one has to choose examples very carefully to illustrate the concept and ideas that you're trying to get across to the students. And I think I've been a success at teaching at elementary levels, and I hope at graduate levels as well, all the way there.
Have you noticed a change in the level of preparation of undergraduates coming through the department in the decades you've been teaching here?
Yes, I think, well, you know, it sort of goes both ways. When I first started teaching here, we were teaching this course, Math 101, Intermediate Algebra, to several hundred people a year. I mean, I taught a large lecture with a couple of hundred students. There were probably other large lectures, and this was every semester. So maybe, I don't remember exactly, over 500, maybe as many as 800 students who had to take this course because they really didn't have the level of mathematics to even to start on the college-level courses. It was basically a remedial course. The university, of course, over the years now has increased the mathematics requirement. I think officially it is 3 years of high school mathematics. It's either the integrated math or 2 years of college algebra and geometry. And so that's the minimum mathematics requirement. I think it's hard for anybody to get into this university without 4 years of high school mathematics, okay, no matter what their major happens to be, because by and large, admission is not based on what your planned major is going to be. It's just based on, I guess, what college you're going to go into. And if you're going into the College of Letters and Sciences, you're a potential science, mathematics major, or what. But so the number of those students who are now taking that course is really decreased over the years. And now it's just maybe one or two sections of 20 students a year that take that course. And because the students are better, they're a bit higher than that, okay? There's still a lot of students taking this college algebra course, which is basically high school mathematics at a somewhat more advanced level, at a college level. But by and large, what really should happen is that this course should be, people shouldn't have to take that course, okay? They should, if they're going to take any further mathematics, they should be able to start with calculus, okay? But that doesn't happen. We have a large number of students taking still college algebra and trigonometry. And what I hear from my colleagues, because I haven't taught calculus much, is that the algebraic facility of students has really gone down. They don't know how to do algebraic manipulations.
Really?
And there's some question whether that's because of the reliance on calculators and software programs to do these things for you. I mean, graphing, you can get graphing calculators that do these things. You can get answers by using calculators. And their ability to do algebraic manipulation seems to have decreased. But that does not mean this is true of all students. We're getting some wonderful students that come here. We get high school students coming from Madison West. We've had several who basically have almost completed an undergraduate math major here while still as a high school student.
Really?
Yes, and I've had experience with at least three of them. One is this fellow you may have heard, seen something in the newspaper about him, Daniel Kane, who is now going to be graduating from MIT, undergraduate, BS degree. He has already published about 10 research papers in mathematics. And he took my introductory combinatorics when he was a high school student at West. There's this remarkable Lowe family, L-O-H, in Madison.
Yes, I've heard. Yes.
Father is a statistics professor, mother was a mathematics teacher. There are at least three children in this family, and I had the son for our sophomore level linear algebra course. When he was a high school student, he went off to Caltech as an undergraduate and then spent a year in England. I think he's now getting a PhD from Princeton. His sister was a student in my introductory combinatorics course. She's also at Caltech. And I don't think I had the third child or member of that family. I think also may have gone to Caltech. But when I taught this Math 475 combinatorics course, when the low child was there and when Daniel Kane was there, they were the best student in the class. And they were high school students at the time. Hmm. So there are some remarkable students these days, and we get some remarkable undergraduates who come here, you know, who haven't been here from high school. But I mentioned this student who's currently at West High, wants to take my introductory course next September when he'll be a senior in high school now, and he's already gone through calculus and whatever, I don't know, here in Madison. So
this concludes side two of tape four.